This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan. Suara Rakyat Malaysia, Suaram, recently released their 2023 Human Rights Report. So on today's show, we will be taking a look at the various human rights violations that have occurred throughout the year, or at least last year here in Malaysia, and look at the changes that should happen this year, 2024. So joining me on the show today to unpack their report is Janelle Tan. She's the Documentation and Monitoring Coordinator at Suaram. As always, this conversation is also available as a podcast. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on Spotify, the BFM app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. So, Janelle, welcome to the show. How are you? It's been a while since I spoke to you on air.
Thanks, Tasha, for having me back. It's good to be back again.
All right. So, let's just start with an overview. Give me an overview of 2023, Janelle. How did Malaysia do in terms of human rights?
I would like to quote the opening statement that my executive director gave on behalf of Suaram during our report event, launch event around 2 to 3 weeks ago. And I would say this phrase is quite responsive, i.e. in limbo. So on one hand, you see certain reforms being pushed forward, and which is good. You know, for example, you see, the Sexual Offences Against Children Act 2017 amendments, right, which basically helps improve, you know, in combating child sexual exploitation and abuse. You also see, for example, amendments to the Evidence of Witness Act, which helps again to better protect child witnesses in the criminal justice system. If you're talking about, you know, more hardline reforms, you know, something like the Ombudsman Bill, and also even the Public Defenders Bill. So these were at least last year, you know, in the midst of being drafted and, you know, correspondingly consultations. So these are good. So that's one hand. On the other hand, you have regressive laws that are continuously being applied, and we will definitely discuss more further, you know, things like the Sedition Act. You also have SOSMA, which, you know, civil society has been advocating for amendments or repeal for the longest time. You also have definitely the public assemblies. So the usual tactics being brought forward by law enforcement, you know, to restrict, in some ways, curtail the right to peaceful assembly. But that's essentially an overview.
Were your expectations met in terms of the direction of this country, in terms of human rights? Because, you know, especially given that this is a reformist government, or at the very least, a government led by reformists.
We on one hand, we do sort of acknowledge that change needs time. However, given the background of certain policymakers in government, especially those who have, you know, when previously they were in opposition, they fought alongside civil society. They spoke out even, you know, on reforms, on the need for reforms, such as, let's say, the Independent Police Conduct Commission. So back then, during the Perikatan National Administration, members of the Pakatan Harapan Coalition, when they were in Parliament, they actually voiced out that the IPCC Act was actually a watered-down bill. So at one point, they were actually alongside civil society opposing, you know, such acts. And on the other hand, when they're in government, you would expect them to sort of, you know, commit to these reforms. And on certain fronts, some reforms have not been sort of pushed forward and some relatively slow. So at least on civil society's side, we would say that, yes, on some points, certain improvements need to be made ASAP.
So let's dive into, earlier you gave some, you listed down a few achievements, setbacks. Could you dive into some of these notable achievements and setbacks, and how we have progressed in these areas? What would Suaram like to highlight?
So one of Suaram's key areas is definitely SOSMARA, which is a procedural law used in lieu of the Criminal Procedural Code to arrest and detain suspects, alleged suspects. And for the first time, and it was literally smack bang on Christmas last year, the police used SOSMARA to arrest and detain, for the very first time, drug syndicate members. And the narrative used was that by the current DIGP, the Deputy Inspector General of Police, that the current other laws are not adequate enough. And this is the biggest, quote-unquote, the biggest drug drug syndicate in Sabah with transnational links. But on the other hand, we argue that that's not necessarily justifiable, because if you know so much about the modus operandi, and they've actually, if you read through their, you know, their statement, you will notice that they actually know quite a bit about the modus operandi, even the assets owned by the drug syndicate. And they've actually they've managed to apprehend 10 or 11 of the members like quite swiftly. So do you necessarily need SOSMA when you can use the dangerous drugs and ID52 as what you have always done with, raids, right? So that's the very concerning part. So we are concerned that when you start doing that, when SOSMA was already in the past used against political detainees, you and I know this, mm-hmm. So that provides room with the historical record as well. That provides room for abuse of power and more draconian crackdowns for no justifiable reason, violating the right to fair trial. So that's one. In terms of public assemblies, I would say it's the ongoing usual in post-assembly investigation. So even though you might have notified the police, you and I know this, there is no such thing as a permit, but we still see the narrative of no permit, no rally thing out there.
Right.
Yeah. And you also have, in some cases, police barricades, the Lawan Lapa rally outside parliament. That was not the first time. During the PN's rule, you have it against the lawyers during the Walk of Judicial Independence. And other things such as even the pre-rally investigations, you see that in the Save Malaysia rally. So there is a clear, we would expect this to not happen in the current administration, but somehow this came up in repeat.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about SOSMA a little bit, because this is essentially detention without trial. It's very draconian. It clearly doesn't follow the principles of human rights. Why does the government, even a government led by Pakatan Harapan, lack the will to abolish the likes of SOSMA? I obviously, you can't answer on behalf of the government, but from your perspective, because Swaram has been pushing for detention without trial for many years, that is essentially the core DNA of Swaram, right?
Yeah.
And one would hope that the people who have been detained without trial in the past, they've been pushing to abolish this. Once they actually come into power, that they will be leading the charge to abolish this. But what we tend to notice is that regardless of what people champion, what they campaign, the platforms they campaign on before elections, once they come into power, this seems to be something that is difficult to get rid of. And often the argument brought up is security issues. How do we deal with organized crime? How do we deal with big-time gangsters and kingpins and drug lords and terrorists and so on and so forth? What is your response to this?
Yeah, you're right, Darshan, about the national security narrative. That has been cropping up time and time again, and it's being recycled by, the Home Minister, on and off, right? And also law enforcement. But honestly, if you look at the national security question, honestly, I don't think it's that straightforward. First of all, we have to note that when it comes to the use of SOSMA, right, based on Swaram's documentation over the last at least 3 years, 3 to 4 years, right? I would say 2018 or 2019 onwards, right? According to media reported cases at least, and sometimes even statistics disclosed through parliamentary questions, there are hardly any terrorism-related cases under which SOSMA is used. In fact, now almost all of it is actually in human trafficking. So, and you can use other laws to sort of, apprehend transporters and even the highest leadership within human trafficking syndicates. So that's one. I would also like to take this opportunity to highlight, because on one hand, the government touts this national security narrative. On the other hand, they also contradictorily bring up the, as you uphold national security, you also try to balance or try to uphold rights for all. That's what they usually say if you look at the parliamentary replies. But we would like to differ on this because at least, for the detainees' families who are not even supposed to be implicated, if you look at the effects of arbitrary detention on them, right? Because as you and I know, when it comes to SOSMA, right, bail is usually not granted unless you're a woman, you're a child, or if you're deemed to be sick or infirm by the court. Sick or infirm is another separate matter because you may come across cases where detainees with chronic health conditions. I'm talking about, you know, gout or heart disease, kidney disease, diabetes. If all four of these in one person, the court does not necessarily grant bail. And, you know, chronic diseases do take up quite a bit.
Right.
So on the other hand, you know, so for breadwinners, in most cases, SOSMA detainees are actually breadwinners, they're men. And when you don't give them the chance to bail, families lose their income overnight. And when you do that, it actually affects the spouse, their capacity to compensate through work. You're also talking about permanent loss of income. So even if the spouse earns, you know, tries to get a job, the chances of even recovering that would be very slim, because you have to consider, for example, additional expenditures. Like, let's say if the person is in prison, most likely, right? To travel back and forth, to visit lawyers, all that stuff. The money goes there. It doesn't go to the family. The children's well-being get affected. Education get affected. So the trickle effect socioeconomically is actually relatively great. So the national security... And Soran would definitely also like to put forward this, whereby across the detainees that we have interviewed, you know, for our study on the socioeconomic impact, a lot of them were actually apprehended without much evidence. So, for example, they might have just donated relatively innocuously to an NGO via WhatsApp. And then the next thing that happens would be that they will be rounded up alongside other people and detained under SOSMA. So these people somehow innocently were arrested and detained, and they also went through, you know, depending on the circumstances, false confessions, alleged torture, and etc. So national security concern, not so straightforward a narrative.
And, you know, I think sometimes there's also a misalignment between people's imagination due to government narratives and the reality on the ground, right? Because sometimes people imagine that those that are detained under SOSMA are the biggest, most vile criminals and organized crimes, crime bosses and whatnot, you know, global terrorist organizations and et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, obviously, you know, the imagination, maybe we need, you know, the harshest, strongest laws to apprehend these people. But, you know, I attended Suaram's program last year where y'all unpacked the report that y'all produced, the study that y'all did. And from my understanding, it feels like most of these people who are detained under SOSMA, people wrong place, wrong time, and oftentimes people very low on the socioeconomic ladder.
And also not to mention that the families also want certainty, because without the provision of bail, and not to mention there's also this observation where, I mean, yes, you get charged and caught 28 days after you get detained. Yeah, that's fine. But the thing is, what happens is that there's usually this long wait whereby you have to wait for your hearing date. And then in that period of time, they will be within detention. So the families would have to wait for at least, you know, based on the cases that Soram receives, it's like 2 to 3 years. So families go by years just waiting, like just wanting to know, like, if their, you know, loved one is actually guilty or not. So, and this one also is another big source of anguish, because SOSMA inherently also entails stigma.
Right.
It also affects the family. Like, it might make them move between states. Children might get bullied in schools because, you know, their peers would tease or bully them that, oh, their parent is detained in custody, and it's because it's under SOSMA. So the effects of that, and not to mention as well, like, aid given, whether there's even financial assistance given, you know, to the families whilst the detainees are in detention, because, you know, they lose income, right? And what's more, even if the detainee is released, right, because we did in the study, I'm sure you know, in the study that we had, we also interviewed former detainees who got out, right? So they also had trouble finding jobs because bank accounts, they can't access bank accounts. Bank accounts are frozen, and they have to go back and forth between the bank and police just trying to get this sorted out. In some cases, you know, where they may have business out of the country, they also had difficulty traveling out, you know, to get business. So these are just some of the substantial issues that still remain.
All right, let's go for a very quick break. On the show with me today is Janelle Tan. She's the Documentation and Monitoring Coordinator at Swaram. We will be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Janelle Tan. She's the Documentation and Monitoring Coordinator at Swaram, and we're unpacking Swaram's latest human rights report. As mentioned earlier, this conversation is also available as a podcast. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on Spotify, the BFM app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. So, Janelle, do we need to reform the police? If so, why? What are key things that your report highlights?
Among the areas that our report highlights when it comes to right to justice is actually death in custody. So death in custody, at least by our documentation, it has reduced media reported ones. We haven't received the parliamentary statistics yet.
Right.
So 14 cases last year. That will be a reduction by around 10 cases compared to 2022. And 2022 source is from the actual criminal investigation unit that conducts investigations on death in custody. In terms of, well, the bulk of it is police custody somehow. Somehow the trend that we see is that when it comes to media reported cases, there is hardly any of it that comes from immigration. But if you look at the parliamentary statistics revealed through parliamentary questions, immigration is actually, it can be among the highest, like over the last 5 to 6 years.
Right.
So like from 2017, 2018, 2022, immigration DIC has somehow topped first or second in prevalence, but media reported hardly any. So that's DIC in short. We also do cover IPCC as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's primarily focusing on the inherent gaps because civil society, including Swaram, have been staunchly advocating to amend the past IPCC in 2021. Because prior to this, you and I know the predecessor, the IPCMC, the Independent Police Conduct and Miscomplaints Committee, right? So that one, so the IPCMC had, in its initial form, actually granted the committee with adequate investigative powers and also even disciplinary powers. You and I know that having these two adequate powers are extremely important in ensuring that the oversight mechanism functions effectively. Right, but the current IPCC, while definitely it shaves off most of the investigative powers, so one of the stuff that really, I would say, makes the IPCC weak is that the police officers that are called, right, by the IPCC, they can decide what information they want to disclose. If they think that, if they deem the information disclosed to be prejudicial to national security and all that, they won't say a single thing. They can choose not to say a single thing to the IPCC. So that's an example of the weak investigative powers. For disciplinary ones, that's extremely important because in the IPCMC previously, the commission would, in principle, have the power to sort of like mete out certain disciplinary measures, you know, against officers who have, you know, found to be breaching code of conduct. But IPCC, on the other hand, right now, they don't have that at all. Rather, they can only refer, they can only pass on recommendations to the Police Force Commission. And yet, the Police Force Commission is not mandated to respond.
Right.
Not even, let alone take action on recommendations.
Right.
So that's the weaknesses that we have been speaking out against as well.
Yeah, so what is, you know, whether it's Swaram or, you know, when you talk to human rights organizations that are part of this movement with you guys, where do NGOs stand on the matter now? Because for the longest time, you know, Swaram and others were pushing for IPCMC, like you mentioned, which would have been a far more
robust
way of dealing with, you know, possible police misconducts and so on and so forth.
Mm.
But now we have the IPCC, which is fairly toothless on the ground.
Mm.
How do we, what is Swaram's approach to this? Are we, are y'all still pushing for IPCMC? Are y'all looking to tighten up the IPCC? What is Swaram's stance on that?
Mm. We're looking to improve the current IPCC because right now the IPCC is already established.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, based on updates by the Home Minister, Saifuddin Astion, early this year, 5 out of 7 are already appointed and they're already running. In fact, Swaram did recently visit did pay a courtesy visit to the IPCC sort of commission members, and there was some form of engagement. And yes, honestly, the powers will need to be improved. It's not so much about repealing the current one and replacing with IPCMC. Rather, it's about improving the current IPCC and putting in place the powers that civil society has advocated for during IPCMC's time. And I would say that, well, I'd rather Swaram would say that it's extremely important, because if you look at, you know, the spate of police misconduct, I mean, this is not the first time it's happening. Like, for example, right, like this year, I think within just the 3 months alone, we did sort of notice, like, media reported cases alone. Huh? By that, we're referring to corruption, extortion, kidnapping, rape, and a few other, drug possession and all that. Like, just media reported cases within the first 3 months alone is already, what, at least 12 to 14? And that's just reported. Mm. And over the years, like, prior to this, we have seen, like, you know, the spate of misconduct cases and the effect it has on the public. And the media articles did highlight, you know, in the past, whereby, you know, the public got very angry, frustrated, deepening mistrust between the public and the police institution. So you can then see the importance of having this institution, because it acts to sort of assure the public that there is accountability when it comes to police misconduct. It doesn't matter whether it's less than 1% or 2% as what's asserted by the police, but what matters is that the public want to see proper accountability being taken. And the only way forward is to have this independent oversight mechanism that would have adequate powers to sort of, you know, see through investigations and mete out relevant disciplinary measures against police officers with misconduct.
Here's the thing. Instead of taking steps in that direction, the direction that you have just suggested, NGOs have suggested over many years, the current Madani government appears to be giving the police more powers, as seen in the recent Police Act amendments. What are your thoughts on this, direction?
At least for Swaram, alongside the Police Accountability Cluster, we did issue a press statement recently in response to the amendments. And among the criticisms that we've brought forward is, one is the increased penalties under Section 21 of the Police Act, which increases the previous fine from 200 to 10,000. Yes, it may just be up to 10,000, but then if you look at Section 233 of the Communications and Multimedia Act, right? I mean, the maximum threshold is also very disproportionate, and the Sedition Act as well for first-time offence. So, although yes, you can argue that there's deterrent effect, and yes, it's just up to, and yes, there might be court discretion, but the fact of the matter is that there is a range, and there is room for very disproportionate penalties for situations may just be... rightful or reasonable effort on the public's part to defend your rights, and it might just be the police's stance otherwise, right? So would you want to penalise someone just on that basis? Not necessarily. So that's really pretty much our stance on Section 21. There was some concern, I believe, as well, on the designation of the Yang Di Pertuan Agong as the Honorary Commission-in-Chief. Something about separation of powers, violation of the separation of powers doctrine, but these were some of the criticisms that were leveraged by civil society. And there was one more thing, which was because Section 21, going back to Section 21, it did cover carry out escort duties on any public road. So there was, because the provision is relatively broad, there is concern that it might overlap unnecessarily and unwarrantedly into public assemblies, because public assemblies can be held on public roads. So let's say if Section 21 is misused to sort of curtail right to peaceful assembly instead, because to the civil society's understanding, there might not be guidelines that facilitate a distinction. So there's the concern, especially with the ramp up of the penalty.
So you mentioned Sedition Act and Section 233 of the Communications and Multimedia Act. And how have these laws affected freedom of expression over the past year?
In many ways, it's pretty much the same as previous administrations.
So business as usual.
Business as usual, unfortunately. I mean, actually, the Sedition Act, right? I mean, by our documentation, the Sedition Act actually increased. The number of cases increased by 60%+ between last year and the year before. Investigations and charges. Charges not so much, but especially investigations. Section 233 of the CMA, on the other hand, has reduced slightly. But charges are more or less the same. And by charges, for last year, we have included... because there have been cases that may have happened prior to last year, but right. The court charges took place, you know, in 2023. Mm. So last year's charges was a mix of, old cases, quote-unquote old cases, and newly occurring cases. But one trend is for sure, and you will also see it in the Center for Independent Journalism's report as well, that when it comes to, yes, you might be starting off with investigations under the Sedition Act. In fact, when it comes to FOE in general on 3R issues, the very typical spate of provisions that the police would usually use would be at least Section 41 of the Sedition Act and also Section 233. But the thing is, when it comes to the court charge, right, in most cases, Sedition Act is dropped.
Right.
But Section 233 is retained instead. So you can argue to a great extent that the government might choose not to use Section 41 Sedition Act because Sedition Act is relatively more controversial, right, given mm-hmm. its colonial era legacy background. But Section 233, you can argue that it's now being used. I mean, it has been continuously used to curtail or criminalize freedom of expression because, you know, it doesn't have the stigma as a Sedition Act.
So the government's argument is that, you know, these laws are used again to, you know, to protect the peace and harmony of this country, especially with regard to 3R issues. Because this government has been on the receiving end of backlash, specifically from their core base, because they've been promising their core base for a good 20, 25 years now that these are, laws, draconian laws that will be abolished once they come into power. But now their stance is sort of like, we need to improve these laws instead of abolishing it. What we need to do is perhaps say that we can use it for, or we shouldn't, people shouldn't be charged if they are saying things against politicians. But there are certain areas, perhaps issues pertaining to race and religion, but especially pertaining to royalty, where their argument is that these laws should be sort of retained and used to, again, maintain that peace and harmony. How would you rate, how would you respond to these arguments by the government, and how would you rate their approach to, managing these 3R issues, race, religion, royalty?
So I would probably start off by the rate and the approach. Mm-hmm. Business as usual in general, but if you notice the statements that have been released by policymakers, especially within the first half year of 2023, especially, like, they were quite swift in, especially like the Minister of Communications and Digital back then, before the ministry split, right? And also even in some cases the Prime Minister himself. There will be these warnings that will be issued whereby, you know, don't go near 3R and et cetera and et cetera. So you see a very, you can say, something akin to a policing stance by the policymakers. And not to mention the 3R task force was also set up. I mean, yes, prior to this, I believe there were 3R-related investigations being done. But last year, an exclusive task force was set up. And they did report from time to time the number of cases that they were investigating and the outcomes and etc. So in that sense, in terms of investigations and etc., business as usual, plus being a little bit much more, can say, hardline. When it comes to policy-related matters, as you've rightly pointed out, Darshan, like, the Pakatan Harapan Coalition did promise to repeal the Sedition Act, but of course they U-turned on that after they came into power. For Section 233, at least by the parliamentary reply issued by the Deputy Minister of Communications, she did clarify that there would be stakeholder consultations done on Section 233. It's just, I believe by November last year, there were no more updates after that. To some extent, stakeholder consultations were not yet complete. they might be resumed this year. So in that, on that ball of, on that court, or on that front for policy matters, generally has been a lot more slower. Of course, back in July as well, the law minister, the law institutional reform minister, did, you know, bring up the possibility of, well, she came up with something much more open, whereby, you know, we would be exploring how to tackle 3R issues. So she did not say upfront back then whether they're going to improve or tighten the Sedition Act, whether they're going to abolish it or whatever, but she kept it open. But then again, that was somehow retracted after a while. So at least on the policy front, things have been relatively stagnant. Back to your question about how we respond, right, to that narrative, right? Well, generally, there would be alternatives. So I'm sure you would be aware of the national harmony bills that were proposed multiple times by the Bar Council. So honestly, the issue here is hate speech, right? Race, racial and religious hate speech. The Sedition Act and Section 233 have been criticised on multiple fronts and also within the international community in terms of the violation of these provisions on basic principles when it comes to freedom of expression. Of course, we know that freedom of expression is not absolute, but there should be narrow grounds, you know, that allow for restrictions. And in all cases, i.e. legitimacy, proportionality, and provided by the law, the Sedition Act and Section 233 have violated all of these three principles. And not to mention with the Sedition Act on the part about the royalty, the international community would tell you that lese majeste provisions are not accepted because the monarchy is a public figure, and a public figure would be, you know, they should be able to accept public criticism. There shouldn't be any distinction. So basically, the government should be really prioritizing, you know, national harmony bills, which would purportedly provide a clearer distinction between what constitutes hate speech and what constitutes not hate speech. Right now in the Sedition Act, there is nothing in the definition. You're talking about very vague terms like seditious tendency. On Section 23, you're talking about terms like annoy. Annoy is just too vague. I mean, there's nothing to define that.
Exactly. That's why it's called akta sakit hati. Some people.
That's why sakit hati, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Anything can be, you know, annoy, deemed annoying and things like
help.
That. Yeah.
It doesn't help with addressing polarized, because right now, I mean, you and I see the discourse, like the reactions by the public towards incidents. I mean, swift action, yes, but it doesn't help to, in the long term, it doesn't help to rectify or address the underlying racial and religious polarization that belie the narrative. So,
does the Malaysian public have more freedom to assemble, more freedom for dissent, to push back against the current government in protests and so on and so forth over the past years? Were there any violations of people's right to assemble, dissent, and so on and so forth in 2023?
Yeah. So basically, as what I've mentioned earlier, business as usual, even for freedom of peaceful assembly, because the Peaceful Assembly Act 2012, despite amendments, you know, despite the amendments in 2019, you know, i.e. reducing the notification period to 5 days, that doesn't really sort of fundamentally the police mindset on quote-unquote the need for a permit remains to some extent not addressed. That's why you see, let's say, when organisers go to the police station to notify the police that they're going to have this public assembly XYZ, you will find that organisers will tell you that police will say that, oh, I need a permit in order to proceed with this. Or let's say if, you know, in most cases, a lot of the public assemblies are held in public spaces, and you and I know it'll be Dataran Merdeka. So the very common justification that be provided by the police would be that you don't have the, you need to go and get consent from the occupier of the space, but this is not warranted because Dataran Merdeka is owned by the public. The city council is only a guardian. It's not, in many ways, you don't need consent from them. So rather, the consent should only be restricted if the public assembly is held on private property, which in most cases you don't really use. So that these are some of the long-standing issues that still persist and should be addressed. And some tactics on certain sensitive, quote-unquote, sensitive assemblies, yes, we may have seen, you know, like during Perikatan Nasional's time, you know, relatively more drastic measures, like, for example, the Azam Baki rally, right? They really tried to stop the protesters from getting there at the place that they blocked the roads even, right? And yes, there were police barricades as well. You may see to some extent a reduction in that, probably a narrower scope of these actions being applied. Nevertheless, these actions are still applied. The police barricade, as I've mentioned, outside Parliament, that's another long-standing issue that needs to be addressed. In fact, if civil society wants to speak to policymakers or submit a memorandum to MPs in Parliament, they can't even get close to, they can't even go past the main gate. They're only allowed, you know, as far as the empty space outside the main gate, which should not be the case.
Which is absolutely ridiculous, given that Parliament houses representatives of the people.
Yes.
This is the people's house, it's the August house.
You so like, should be.
Right. So there shouldn't be these kinds of restrictions.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, you should be able to meet your representatives. You shouldn't be barred outside the gate to not see them, right? So that's unfortunately another issue. And there is one, I mean, I'd like to highlight two very specific instances, in fact. Like, so Swaram did sort of observe that there was, this is according to news reports, so there was one assembly that was meant to be held in November by the Bukit Jelutong Residents Association, but the police did not allow that to be held on rationales such as the place that they wanted to campaign at, or sorry, not campaign, sorry, protest at, is not conducive. So instead of using that to stop them from holding the assembly, you should actually be working with the residents to sort of like identify, or if this cannot, then where else can you actually assemble instead of stopping them? So that's one very notable incident for law enforcement under the current administration. The other one, of course, is the relatively high profile protests in relation to the forced eviction in Kuantan Perak. You see arrest and detention, of course, of three activists and one farmer, and equally importantly, a human rights an activist who was injured by an enforcement official from the Perak Land and Mines Office. She went to file a police report, but she was arrested instead under Section 186, obstruction of duty. So this one is completely unwarranted.
Absolutely. So on that note, do we see an improvement, or are we seeing a regression in terms of the way the public or the state treats other marginalized groups, such as migrants, refugees, sexual minorities, so on and so forth?
Swaram's report does cover at great lengths, you know, through the work by external authors on these marginalized groups. I'll just highlight a couple of observations that would be very, you know, significant. Under the current administration last year, like, there has been, I would say, or rather the author would say, a hike or a spike in raids. So the government has been very steadfast when it comes to nabbing, especially undocumented migrants, and they do conduct raids across the country. And as you know, very usually, you know, during the festivities or public holidays, they usually would do that during in the Kuala Lumpur and certain hotspots, right? So they have definitely ramped up the raids, and migrants, documented migrants, may be caught in between. For undocumented migrants, of course, you know, as you and I know, they will go straight to the immigration detention camps, and given the Human Rights Watch recent report, that doesn't bode well at all. So, and as you and I know as well, when it comes to access to justice in those situations, generally migrants, they have very limited access to justice, so that doesn't help either. And there's also the notable case where the 200 plus Bangladeshis, right, they walked to the police station a distance away to file a police report, but they got arrested instead. So that gives you an idea of just how deprived of basic rights, even right to justice, that migrants have. For refugees, unless things have changed, UNHCR does not have access to immigration detention depots still. Although the government has brought forward, I think late in the year, about some form of policy framework on healthcare, employment, education, no updates throughout the rest of last year. To this year, I don't remember coming across any, but that's refugees in short. But otherwise, things are still status quo. And then when it comes to sexual minorities, that one One thing that is new, which came up very late in the year, is actually the rehabilitation center in Johor.
Right.
So that's the first of its kind. Prior to that, it's primarily just programs being rolled out, etc. And by international standards, that these are not acceptable.
You're talking about the quote-unquote, the conversion.
Yes,
centers,
the conversion.
Right?
Yeah. But now they have systematized it, specifically in this case, Johor.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have the usual stuff, like the criminalization via laws. So all that stuff. And in terms of restrictions, so restrictions on right to peaceful assembly here, there was a solidarity rally, and it's just by honestly like 8 to 10 people. And these were religious minorities who support, like, you know, who expressed the solidarity with the LGBT community. And they were actually arrested and detained for exercising their right to peacefully assemble, I believe, for 1 or 2 days before being released. So you can see the restriction of right to peaceful assembly there. Freedom of expression, again, curtailed as usual. Reinstated ban, gay is not okay book, the Swatch Watch, and also the banning. Hmm.
So with all of that in mind, what are the key legislative changes you're hoping to see in 2024?
Quite a few, actually.
Mm-hmm.
SASMA amendments, that's for sure, because stakeholder engagements were done last year. In fact, 13 of them, including CSOs and detainees. So the government should expedite and make sure that they're tabled and enforced by this year. In terms of stakeholder, there's the Freedom of Information Act as well, because mm-hmm. in fact, it's already under progress.
Right.
So it's only natural that we should see it being tabled and enforced this year. The government also aspired to do that, so we're just holding them accountable. In terms of stakeholder engagements, we would definitely say POCA, because early this year, the Home Minister did say they did admit that because by the court, Sections 4 and 15B were declared to be unconstitutional by the courts because they did not provide the courts with their due powers, to scrutinise, right, the government. So because of that, the government the Home Minister admitted that the police could not invoke POCA because of the court's decision. As a result, stakeholder engagements are done. So, but the thing is, now it's just with the police and policymakers and I think recently MPs, not yet CSOs. So these should be done with CSOs to make sure that due perspectives on the ground are collected. Printing Presses and Publications Act, although the government did say, rather the Home Minister did deny that they would amend it, but in case some of us do not know, a questionnaire was actually released by the Home Ministry online, getting feedback. So to us, at least, that's an indication that, you know, if you're gathering input, you might as well reorganize your stakeholder consultations, right?
Right.
Just to make sure, you know, just to provide room for dialogue and hopefully there will be amendments as well to PPPA because they're just too broad. I think last but not least, it's definitely the regressive citizenship amendments.
Right.
From what was reported, two of them were withdrawn, but three of them remain. And as what is brought up by DRA Malaysia, these would affect the stateless persons, especially in Sabah and Sarawak. And so on that basis, the government should, you know, definitely consider withdrawing the three remaining regressive citizenship amendments as well.
You know, you brought up stakeholder engagement. Really quickly, has there been an improvement on that front compared to, let's say, your previous Home Ministries, whether it's the Hamza Zainuddin's, your Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin's, and you know, the various Home Ministries over the 60 years, right? I'm wondering, from Swaram's point of view, is it easier to get into the Home Minister's office and discuss things and so on and so forth?
Generally, no. For the Home Ministry, in fact, we've asserted on multiple occasions that we have not yet managed to really meet key personnel, including the Minister of the Home Ministry himself. So we've been asking for a meeting, or rather, we've been asking that the Home Ministry conducts engages with us directly instead of via, in a detached manner, via press statements and, via press conferences. On your question about the nature of stakeholder engagement, because as you and I know, right, you can't just tick the box. I mean, ticking the box is fine, but you need to make sure that they're inclusive, right?
Yep.
To a great extent, based on our observation, it depends on, the department or the person chairing it. So let's say if you compare, for example, stakeholder engagements done by the Ministry of Higher Education on AUKU, versus the ones on the Freedom of Information Act by the Law and Institutional Reforms Minister, definitely the latter would be a lot more better. We were in the stakeholder consultation in the latter, and they were relatively more, there was some form of discussion, which is good. From what was reported and also shared by the students, right, you know, in the AUKUS or stakeholder town hall, it was really all about just the government just telling them what's supposed to be the right thing. There was allegedly some form of infantilization of university students, treating them like children, especially, you know, those who are women. So there is, as you can see, still a very big gap when it comes on the government's part as to how to really listen to, how to really provide this space where the stakeholders invited can really air out their concerns and whether they're actually really listening. So that's actually something that needs to be improved on.
All right. So before we wrap this conversation up, Janelle, would you have a final message for us?
Final message. The government should definitely go by its human rights for all approach, basically walk the talk, lah. Not just, I mean, and also adhere by the basically the values that they have preached in the Madani framework, because what Madani asked for would be inclusivity, respect for all, accountability, and etc. So there shouldn't be double standards in anything.
Janelle, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Janelle Tan. She's the Documentation and Monitoring Coordinator at Swaram. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.